When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is a reminder that the Path Went Chilly is a discussion podcast in which myself, Ashley, and Jules have in-depth conversations about cases I previously covered on The Trail Went Cold. If you're someone who prefers solo podcasts involving one person, my original Trail Went Cold episodes are available for download. But if you're someone who likes discussion-style podcasts and wants to hear myself, Ashley, and Jules get way more in-depth into these cases I previously covered, then The Path Went Chilly is the podcast for you. Welcome back to The Path Went Chilly. I'm Robin.
I'm Jules.
And I'm Ashley. Let's dive right in.
April 12th, 1994, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. While driving from Oklahoma to New Jersey to see her friend Melissa Shepherd, 23-year-old Karen Denise Wells checks into a motel. Denise phones Melissa and asks her to come meet her there. But when Melissa arrives, Denise has vanished. Later that morning, Denise's abandoned rental car is discovered 35 miles away on a rural road with an empty gas tank, and there are 700 miles on the vehicle's odometer, which cannot be accounted for. Discrepancies open up in Melissa's story, leading to speculation that she's withholding information about Denise's disappearance, but no trace of Denise is ever found.
After that, the path went chilly. So today we're going to cover what I consider to be one of the more underrated and overlooked cases that I have ever covered on The Trail Went Cold, because it's not particularly well known, but it's certainly baffling. It involves a woman who embarked on a lengthy road trip from Oklahoma to New Jersey to see a friend until she disappeared after checking into a motel in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I'm always fascinated by cases in which people go missing or wind up dead at locations that they had no reason to be at, and this is one of the more stranger ones. In this story, the victim's movements don't seem to make a lot of sense, as before she arrived at the motel, Denise was spotted in locations which were much closer to her destination in New Jersey, so there was no apparent reason for her to circle back and wind up in Carlisle. But the strangest detail is that when Denise's abandoned rental car was discovered, investigators were able to add up all the mileage and determine that there were around 700 miles on the odometer which could not be accounted for. This seems to indicate that Denise had gone out of her way to travel to some additional locations during her trip, and would eventually become apparent that her friend in New Jersey probably knew more than she was telling. But to this day, no one has been able to determine where those additional 700 miles came from, or what actually happened to Denise, so we're really going to be racking our brains trying to figure out a logical answer. This story is actually a bit reminiscent of the series of episodes we recently released about the death of Patrick Sean Kelly, though in this particular case, the victim has never been found.
This one is terrifying from what you just described, because Denise had already checked into the hotel, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And as we're going to reveal, she actually called Melissa to come meet her there because she might have thought she was in trouble or something. But by the time Melissa arrived, Denise and her car were gone, and no one knows why it was found 35 miles away on that abandoned road.
It really worries me because when you guys talk about the case, you said that Melissa knew more than she was saying, And that's horrifying in its own self. A friend you would call to help you might in some way be involved or know information and not be willing to help.
Yeah, Melissa is a very suspicious character, and I really don't know what to make of her, but we'll go into more details about her as we go along.
Our story begins in 1994, and our central figure is 23-year-old Karen Denise Wells, who goes by the name Denise. Denise lives in her hometown of Haskell, Oklahoma, and is raising an 18-month-old son named William. Denise was known for being a bit of a wild teenager, and after graduating from high school, she moved to South Dakota to live with her aunt. While there, Denise ran into a few problems, including a criminal conviction for check forgery, though she only received a sentence of probation. By the time she returned to Haskell, Denise was pregnant with William. While there's no information out there about who the child's father was, it sounds like he was completely out of the picture by this point, and Denise would end up raising William as a single mother. She got a part-time job at Haskell Airport, and while Denise eventually found herself unemployed, she was apparently handling her situation quite well and was known for being a very loving parent.
It sounds like she's really fighting for stability and to try to get her life together. You know, making moves, being with family members who might support her, trying to get a job, maybe didn't work out long term. But imagine being so young, being a single mother with no support from the father, and kind of having all of these big life changes happen all at once. It sounds like Denise was trying to do the very best she could so that William would have more stability than she was having in her own life.
Yeah, that's one of the big unanswered questions of this case, is why exactly she made such a long road trip to New Jersey. And some people, as we're going to talk about later on, speculate that maybe she might have gotten involved in something that would have given her some additional income that she desperately needed because she had recently lost her job.
I find it striking how people point out that she was handling it really well, that she lost her job. And like, Ash, you've been a single mother, but for completely different reasons. You had steady employment, but I'm sure you can speak to how difficult it is not really knowing what the future is like. But for someone as young as Denise, having an 18-month-old son and then having no prospects of any jobs on the horizon and no steady income, you could see how potentially somebody could fall into doing something illegal or questionable because you're just simply trying to put food on the table for your kid.
Oh, 1,000%. I talk to my students about this in controversial issues classes all the time. Like, you know, when you talk about sex work and you talk about drug sales, there's a lot of environments where criminal activity is easily going to be more productive and it's going to be, you know, a better provider for your family, for yourself, for, you know, in making a future, a home, things like that. So as easy as it is for people who haven't struggled like that to say, you know, why would you do that? It's also very easy to look at, am I going to go make minimum wage somewhere or am I going to go make quick money with a lot of potential to turn over quick, you know, very quickly? So I get it. I totally get it.
On the afternoon of April the 10th, Denise made the surprising decision to go on a 1,300-mile cross-country road trip. Her destination was North Bergen, New Jersey, where she was planning to visit an old high school friend of hers named Melissa Shepherd. Melissa now made her living as an exotic dancer, and according to Denise, she was depressed and experiencing quote-unquote personal problems. So Denise wanted to persuade Melissa to return back home to Haskell in order to get her life straightened out. Denise would leave William with her parents and told them she expected to be gone between 4 days to a week. While the amount of total driving time from Haskell to New Bergen was over 20 hours, Denise was apparently planning to make the entire trip nonstop. And even though she owned a car, Denise drove to Tulsa in order to rent a 1993 Plymouth Acclaim for the drive, leaving her own vehicle at the rental place. Unfortunately, Denise would become a missing person just over 2 days later, and a number of perplexing questions would emerge about a road trip.
I find it very interesting that Melissa was the one that Denise was going to help, because it sounded like Denise was struggling in her own right. And while really, you know, handling it well, Melissa's the one who Denise sets off and says, I'm going to bring her home. In my head, I was thinking maybe it was Melissa who had lured her out to maybe be an exotic dancer with her, showing her that it could provide all of this money. But at the end of the day, it sounds like Denise was the one trying to kind of, quote, save Melissa and bring her home with her.
Yeah, that part of the story is very ambiguous because that's all Denise told her parents, that I have to go help Melissa because she's got these personal problems. And even though Denise was unemployed at that time, she still did have a stable support system because she had her parents who would help her take care of her son. So she was not completely alone, whereas Melissa may have been involved in something else. And that's what compelled Denise to make this lengthy trip in order to compel her to return back home.
Just feels like Denise has enough of her own problems right now. Do you know what I mean? Like dealing with the fact that she's unemployed, she's got this young son, and then to go and bring Melissa back home. I mean, I'm not saying that she wasn't a good friend and that she wouldn't do this, but it just seems like, is she overstating the personal problems of Melissa? Is she potentially mixed up in the same thing that Melissa's mixed up in? And she's just trying to kind of omit certain details from what she's telling to her parents.
I think it's possible, but I also think she might have one of those. I mean, I know a lot of people who, including myself, who have the thing where, like, I don't care what I'm going through, I'm always going to try to, like, help the people around me that I love. And so, you know, your issues are one thing, but I'm willing to put my own issues aside to come help you. So I could see her really saying, I do have a lot of support and Melissa doesn't. And if I can get her back here, she can share that support with me. You know, I'm sure her parents cared about Melissa and, you know, Denise would be there and the baby would be there. Maybe Melissa could help her with the baby. So I could see her putting her neck out there to go chase down Melissa.
I think it might have something to do with the fact that Denise had gone through the same thing herself, because she moved to South Dakota and she had got arrested for check forgery and she got pregnant. And once she moved back to Oklahoma, that's when she started to straighten out. So I think she might have felt that Melissa, if she returned to Haskell, would probably go through the same thing.
Shortly before 6 p.m. on the evening of April 12th, Denise arrived in the town of Carlisle, located in Middlesex Township, Pennsylvania, and checked into the Pike Motel. She told the owner that she only needed a place to sleep for 2 or 3 hours and was given a reduced rate on the room, as well as long-distance phone service. After entering the room, Denise received some phone calls from Melissa Shepherd. About a half hour earlier, Denise had called Melissa from a payphone at a nearby gas station. According to Melissa, Denise claimed she was exhausted because she had repeatedly gotten lost on her trip. Denise didn't believe that she would be able to make it all the way to New Bergen on her own, and since Carlisle was still around 200 miles away, she decided to check into the motel so that Melissa could meet her there and accompany her the rest of the way. Denise said she was planning to grab something to eat at McDonald's and would go to bed and grab some sleep before Melissa arrived.
After Denise ended the call, she went to see the motel owner to ask to borrow some matches, but this would turn out to be the last time she was confirmed to be alive. According to the owner, she later received a call from a woman claiming to be a friend of Denise's, asking for directions to the motel. Sometime between midnight and 1 a.m. on April the 13th, Melissa finally arrived and was accompanied by two male companions. After knocking on the door to Denise's room and receiving no answer, Melissa went to see the owner and asked her to call the room's phone. Once again, there was no answer, so the owner had her husband unlock the door and let Denise and her male companions inside the room. While Denise's room key, luggage, and all of her possessions were there, Denise herself was nowhere to be found.
Doesn't that seem like a really long time to make a 200-mile trip to see her friend? Because she checked in before 6 p.m., and they didn't arrive until midnight to 1 a.m. So that's a 6-hour, 7-hour gap to drive 200 miles to see your friend.
Yeah, we're going to go into more detail about this later on the episode, about the timeline and the distance between these two places. But it would later turn out that a lot of phone calls were made from Denise's room to Melissa's residence in New Jersey. So it is possible that Melissa did not start her trip until a couple hours after Denise arrived at the motel.
Okay.
But that's the thing, is that we really only have Melissa's word about the contents of the phone call. So she may not be telling the whole truth. And for some reason, maybe she decided to go there at a later time for different reasons.
That makes sense. So it's possible that the last phone call they had was at 8 or 9, and then they decided to all get in the car and come.
Exactly.
It's this weird timeline and all this ambiguity, which makes me question what the objective was of this trip, of the stay at the motel, and of all of this. But you'll start to see more as we kind of unfold the timeline and unfold all the weird discrepancies in Melissa's story, Ash. So some clothing was found on the floor, which gave off the impression that Denise may have dropped them while changing clothes. There was also a cigarette in the ashtray, which was the same brand Denise liked. And while it appeared to have been lit, it was not smoked. Even though Denise had intended to get some sleep during her stay, the bed didn't appear to have been slept in. There was no noticeable signs of a struggle, and the motel owners did not recall seeing or hearing anything unusual that night. But Melissa became concerned and soon filed a missing persons report with the Middlesex Township Police Department.
Well, I'm assuming, because this is back in the 90s, correct?
Yes, 1994.
Okay, so I'm assuming they're going to be told she has a right to go wherever she wants, and we'll look into this in 24 to 48 hours. Is that true?
Not really, because it would only be a couple hours later when they would find her abandoned car. And once that happened, they realized that something bad must have happened to her.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okie dokie. All right. So they didn't even have to investigate. They didn't even have to go down that trail yet.
Pretty much. And okay. Here's how they discovered the car. It was later that morning at around 5:50 a.m. when Denise's Plymouth Acclaim was discovered abandoned in a rural area on Route 274. The location was 35 miles from the Pike Motel in Perry County near New Germantown and in close proximity to the Tuscarora State Forest. The car was parked in the middle of the westbound lane and both its driver's and passenger side doors were wide open. It had run out of gas and the battery was dead, and the vehicle was also scratched and splattered with mud. A number of items were found inside, including Denise's driver's license, birth certificate, and a probation card from her previous forgery conviction. The car also contained cigarette butts, paper cups, and some McDonald's French fries, as well as wrappers for McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. Most interestingly, there were also small amounts of marijuana inside, a pipe used for smoking marijuana, and traces of what the newspaper accounts described as, quote-unquote, suspected cocaine.
There's a lot to unpack right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, all right. So the car is parked in the middle of a lane. So did someone else find it? Who found the car?
I think it was just people traveling down that road, driving in the middle of the morning, and they found like an abandoned car in the road with all the doors open and no one was around. So naturally, when you see that, you're going to call the police.
Oh, 1,000%. Okay. So it had already run out of gas. The battery was dead, which means it had been probably running for quite a while. And then the vehicle splattered with mud and scratched up, which almost makes it sound like they went on some kind of joyride or through the woods or something like that. I do find it interesting that Denise's driver's license, her birth certificate, and the probation card are all sitting there, because those are things you would need. Let's say she was going to go on the run, or she was going to try to get a plane ticket and get out of the country. She would have needed all of that. I'm not shocked by the kind of junk that was in the car. Cigarette butts, paper cups, McDonald's wrappers. Remember, she had been on a, 1,100-mile drive? So she was probably stopping, you know, every couple hours and grabbing some snacks and throwing the mess in the back seat. Kind of looks like my car. But it is troubling. I mean, nowadays we kind of scoff at, you know, marijuana use and things like that. But here she has marijuana. She has, you know, paraphernalia. And if there really was suspected cocaine in the car, then maybe Denise isn't, you know, managing things in the most healthy way she could have been, even though she really was trying to get on her feet and provide the stability for William. She's still turning to substances to kind of cope with everything that's going on.
But Robin, why is it suspected cocaine? Why couldn't they have just tested it and confirmed or denied it was cocaine? Like, it's pretty simple to run it through and just check what the substance is, no?
Yeah, I'm really confused about that part of the case. And that's why I said traces of what the newspaper accounts described as suspected cocaine, because that's what the sources state, but they don't really go into any specific detail. I don't know if that meant that they found traces that of stuff that looked like cocaine, but if they did test it, the police have never publicly said so. I mean, it could be a simple thing where maybe they found traces of sugar in the car and initially thought it was cocaine, but it turned out not to be. But yeah, the ambiguous wording of that really troubles me.
Yeah, because there's so many different white powdered substances like that I take, say, for supplements. Like collagen is one of them. MSM is another one. I put baking soda in my water with apple cider vinegar on occasion. So there's lots of white substances that could appear to be cocaine. So if you're so sure that it's that drug, then just go that extra step and maybe test it. Or is this a case that law enforcement might know the answer to this and it's just not been released publicly?
Yeah, it's certainly possible that they're deliberately withholding that. Or it's possible that it was just so small that it was untestable, because I know that sometimes happens with evidence like blood where the sample is so small that they cannot perform any adequate testing.
That makes sense too. Denise's change purse, which still had a small amount of cash inside, was discovered in a nearby ditch. But one item which could not be found were the keys to the car. A massive search involving dogs and helicopters would be conducted of the surrounding area, but it failed to turn up any trace of Denise. However, the one aspect of her disappearance which left police completely baffled was the odometer in her car. Since it was a rental, the company kept detailed records of the vehicle's mileage, but there turned out to be a major discrepancy. An average drive from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Carlisle, Pennsylvania would have been just under 1,200 miles. But when investigators tracked Denise's known movements and tabulated all the mileage, they determined that there were around 700 miles on the odometer, which could not be accounted for.
Now, some of that mileage could be because she said she kept getting lost, right? Now, that would be a lot of getting lost because that's, I mean, yeah. What? That's an extra 12 hours or something on, you know, of driving. But yeah, I mean, some of it could be because she was lost. But do we have the exact time she left and the time she got to the motel? Like, could there have been way more than the 22 hours that she was supposed to be driving?
We're going to go into more detail momentarily about her movements because they did trace her in some other towns in Pennsylvania and New Jersey on the same day she went missing before she arrived at the motel. But even if you tabulate all these movements, it's still like cannot total up to the amount found on the odometer. So it just seems really, really difficult to imagine her getting so lost that she could tabulate 700 miles. So it has always made everyone wonder if she made some detours on her trip that she never told anybody about.
And there wasn't enough time for someone to take her from the motel and put 700 miles on it, right? Because that's quite a long drive.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some of it. I mean, she arrived at 6. We don't know what time she left. And then they found it at 5:50 a.m. the following morning. And that's still not a lot of time to drive 700 miles. No. And the fact that it was found only 35 miles from the motel, that seems to indicate that it was not driven that much after she left the motel. So, yeah, there's a big unanswered question here, a big hole about why all those miles were tabulated. If the extra 700 unaccounted miles wasn't enough, once Denise's disappearance received publicity, a witness came forward who reported interacting with her at approximately 11:30 a.m. on the morning of April the 12th. According to the witness, he had pulled over to help a woman matching Denise's description because her vehicle had run out of gas and was stranded by the side of the road. However, this incident took place in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, near Schaeferstown, over 50 miles east of Carlisle. Even stranger, when the witness helped the woman get gas, she mentioned that she had been to New Jersey and was heading towards Oklahoma, so he gave her directions for two separate routes which would take her west. So if Denise was on her way home, why did she check into the Pike Motel 6 hours later, and why would she have needed Melissa to come meet her there and accompany her to New Bergen?
That's very bizarre. I'm wondering if he could have mistaken her, but that sounds too accurate for both where she had been and where she would be going for her home state to be kind of a coincidence, doesn't it?
I think so. Like, what I can see him like mistaking her for another woman, but what are the odds that he would pull over and find another woman in a similar car who mentioned New Jersey and traveling to Oklahoma? That's just too many specific details, which makes me think that he really did interact with Denise. But it really doesn't make much sense that she would say that she was heading to Oklahoma and then wind up at this motel in Carlisle several hours later. 7 months
after Denise went missing, the story took an even more bizarre turn. It turned out that Denise had been conducting an affair with a married man named Mike Douglas, who also happened to be the owner of Haskell Airport, Denise's previous employer. Around Thanksgiving, Mike Douglas's wife claimed that she received a phone call from a female who identified herself as Miss Wells and stated, "This is Denise. Tell Mike I'm not coming home. I'm already married." While Mrs. Douglas thought the caller sounded like Denise, police were skeptical that it was actually her.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay, so she was a part-time employee at the airport, and supposedly she's having an affair with the owner of the airport, which sounds like a really big deal, and he's a married man, and supposedly Denise would have the gall to kind of call the wife and ask her to pass messages along to her husband about not marrying her husband because this girl's already married.
Yeah, I am really skeptical that this was actually her. It doesn't make any sense that she would disappear voluntarily, be gone 7 months, and then the first person which she would call is the wife of the man she had been having an affair with when she has her parents and her son who are concerned about what happened to her. So I don't know who really made this call, if it was some sort of prank, but it doesn't really fit the facts.
It's really disturbing, too, because like you said, wouldn't she need to get in touch with her child and the parents? But even more so, like, don't you wait for Mike to answer the phone and tell him that information, not the wife of the man you're having an affair with?
That's what I'm thinking, that if this was a prank, that they deliberately chose someone who might have not known Denise as well, was maybe just a casual acquaintance, who, if it was someone who knew her better, then maybe they would have recognized her voice and realized it wasn't Denise, but because Mrs. Douglas obviously didn't know her that well, she said, oh yeah, it kind of sounded like her. But you kind of treat that with some skepticism because they weren't, like, close friends or anything. Well, virtually everyone who knew Denise insisted that she was very attached to her son William and would not have run away without attempting to contact him. At the time Denise originally went missing, Melissa Shepherd was very active in the search efforts for her. She stayed in close contact with Denise's family, underwent therapy to deal with her personal problems, and since she had no police record, Melissa was not initially considered to be a suspect. However, in April of 1995, around the one-year anniversary of Denise's disappearance, police publicly announced that after a thorough investigation, they had uncovered a significant amount of discrepancies in Melissa's story and believed that she knew more than she was telling.
That's really tragic for everyone involved. I mean, here you have a woman who's stepping up and being a very active part of an investigation, which we see in a lot of cases, right? People want to assert themselves into a case, even if they may have some involvement. But it's so difficult when you think about the poor family who's saying, here's this childhood friend that in their mind, Denise was setting off to help, right? To maybe even save her and bring her home. She's a childhood friend, a family friend. She's active in the investigation. She's helping us try to get more information. And then all of a sudden you're blindsided by this idea that the woman standing by your side helping might actually be involved in the case. What an added layer of trauma and devastation for the whole family.
And that's one of the interesting things I find when I research cases like this, is I go to newspapers.com and I read them in chronological order. And when I read the original newspaper articles about Denise's disappearance from 1994, Melissa is front and center. She just looks like a good advocate, a good friend. She's very active trying to spread the word. And then you get to the 1995 articles, and then it's all of a sudden, police are suspicious of her because they found some holes in her story. It's just a crazy 180 in regards to Melissa in this case.
It also could be like a big difference in her personal circumstances, because after everything happened with Denise, we see Melissa go down the route of getting therapy and being involved. Maybe she's taking personal accountability and maybe she's digging into her own trauma and her own issues. And then later on, maybe she just kind of abandons that and she's like, oh, I want to leave this behind. I don't want to deal with this. And if she's involved in that lifestyle, say she's still exotic dancing, maybe she's involved in with some kind of people that wouldn't encourage her to go to the police and wouldn't encourage her to cooperate with the investigation, then you could see a complete 180. And I'm not saying she had any addiction issues or whatever, but, you know, her quote unquote personal problems, we don't know all of them. But if it was enough for Denise to drive cross country, well, not quite cross country, but a very long distance to go and get her friend, we know that it must have been fairly serious. So I don't know what's going on with Melissa, but I can see how, like you said, Ash, we see people initially in investigations, or Robin, I think you said it, that people will insert themselves. And it doesn't tell us if they're innocent or guilty, because a good friend would want to be involved. But also, if somebody knew more and they wanted to keep their finger on the pulse of the investigation, they would also want to stay close so they can keep abreast of any new developments. During an article in the Carlisle Sentinel newspaper, the police published an exact timeline of Denise's movements during her final road trip, and there were a number of things which should not make much sense. Throughout the course of her trip, Denise called Melissa's home in New Bergen a number of times. The first phone call took place in Indianapolis on April 11th, and the second took place in the town of Somerset, Pennsylvania, at 6:39 a.m. on the morning of April 12th. These calls did not raise any red flags, as they seemed to correspond with the proper route and time frame of Denise's trip from Oklahoma. The next call from Denise to Melissa took place from a payphone in Schaeferstown at 11:39 a.m., shortly after the motorist helped her get gas. But the problem is that Denise subsequently called her at 3:34 p.m. from a payphone in Burnville, a small Pennsylvania town located in Berks County. Burnville is located approximately 17 miles northeast of Schaeferstown. So if the motorist had given her directions to head west, what was Denise doing in Burnville 4 hours later? And of course, Denise's next call to Melissa took place at 5:27 p.m. from a gas station near Carlisle, a 70-mile drive southwest of Burnville. Phone records would also show that a call was made to Melissa's home from Denise's motel room at 8:05 p.m. But since this was about an hour and a half after she was last seen by the owner, it could not 100% be confirmed if Denise herself made the call.
So basically, you guys are saying between 11:39 and about 6:30, she only drove 87 miles or she was doing something else. So that's, what is that? 11:39 to 6:30. That's almost 7 hours. And all she drove was 87 miles.
Yeah, like I can believe that she went somewhere else before she wound up in Burnville, but they've never been able to determine that. But that's what's extra weird is that she supposedly told this motorist that she was heading home to Oklahoma, which was west, and here she is driving to another town located nearby in Pennsylvania. So either she got really, really lost, or she went somewhere to meet someone for reasons we just don't know.
And none of this actually lends credence to these 700 missing or 700 extra miles on the odometer. If she's going these short distances between towns right before the vehicle is discovered and she goes missing, we still can't explain those 700 miles.
However, the biggest red flag which could not be explained was a call which was made from a payphone at the Sheets Market in Middlesex Township to Melissa's number at 12:50 a.m. on April the 12th, a full 17 hours before Denise supposedly arrived in the area and checked into the Pike Motel. The call went to Melissa's voicemail, but she could not or would not tell police who made the call or what it was about.
That's all. The only thing you know is that a call came in. Like, we don't know it was from Denise or anything like that, right?
We don't. But that's what's weird about it is that Denise shouldn't have been in Carlisle at this particular point in time, because this was 17 hours before she checked into the motel. And if it wasn't Denise, it just kind of seems like a strange coincidence that another person would make a call to Melissa from Carlisle, a town she didn't seem to have any connection to. And the fact that Melissa has not been very open about who made the call, if there was anything on the voicemail, is kind of troubling.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
But there would be a number of other troubling discrepancies in Melissa's story. Remember how I mentioned that she was accompanied by two male companions when she arrived at the motel and reported Denise missing? Well, if you read the original media accounts of the case, they state that Melissa arrived at the motel with her boyfriend. That's the story she originally told police, but when the motel owners confirmed that there were two men with her, investigators learned they were actually casual acquaintances she knew from the bar where she worked. Both men were subsequently interviewed by police and shared a bizarre story. Apparently, when they first arrived at the motel, Melissa, quote-unquote, went ballistic when she noticed that Denise's rental car was not parked outside, even though they had not even gone into her room yet and discovered Denise was missing.
A lot of that stuff is bizarre. You have this idea that two men were with Melissa when she arrives at the hotel. Why would you claim one of them was a boyfriend when these are two casual acquaintances that you knew from some bar where you worked? Remember, she's a exotic dancer. Nothing wrong with that as a choice. But sometimes those are not the nicest upscale facilities like we like to think about, right? There's a lot of underground drug use in some of them. There's a lot of sex trade that goes on in some of those. And so there's a potential that these were not great guys. She doesn't know them very well. So why would she invite them to go on the trip with her in the first place? Why would you lie to the police about your relationship with them? And then it looks almost staged. You know, we're like, I don't know if you guys ever saw that woman who set people up to kill her husband. And she goes up to the police and she just like starts having a freak fest when the police are at her house. They haven't even told her that her husband's dead yet. And it's just overreaction for not knowing all of the details. So it's this idea that she goes ballistic in the parking lot. Denise could have driven to McDonald's. She said she was going to leave the hotel for a few minutes. So why would you panic until she didn't come back or until you were let into the room and realized everything was there?
Yeah, this is the suspicious part of their story. It's almost like she expected that something bad was going to happen when she arrived and that she asked these two guys who she didn't even know that well to come with her as protection because she feared there might be danger. I mean, why give such an obvious lie and tell the police you were with your boyfriend when that could be easily discounted by the motel owner? So you have to wonder, is there a reason Melissa did not want to tell the police that she invited these two particular guys with her?
It's weird, too, because the danger seemed to lie in Melissa's lifestyle, and that's what Denise was getting her away from. So it seems counterintuitive to then bring two of these guys that likely worked with her and were part of this lifestyle as protection. Like, protection from what? Another weird contradiction was that when Melissa spoke to the media following Denise's disappearance to talk about the search efforts, she mentioned that they hadn't been checking bars for her since Denise didn't drink or frequent them. Yet Melissa's male companions claimed that when they found out Denise was not at the motel, the first thing they did was search for her at some local bars. Melissa eventually stopped talking to police and told them that she just wanted to put the incident behind her. In a 2009 article published about the case, the lead investigator mentioned that Melissa's current whereabouts at the time were unknown.
Very bizarre. If Denise does not drink and she doesn't go to bars, why would her best friend or one of her best friends be searching for her at a bar?
Yeah, that makes me wonder if this is another thing she wasn't telling, that maybe for whatever reason she had told Denise to meet someone at a bar there, and that's why that's the first place they started looking for. But Melissa did not want investigators looking in that direction, which is why she lied and said that she never bothered checking any bars. It's just another aspect where you feel that she's not telling the entire story to the police. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking that this would have been an absolutely perfect case to feature on Unsolved Mysteries. And at one point, law enforcement did meet with the show in hopes of getting the case featured, and the producers said they were interested. However, just before they were about to enter the pre-production phase, the network executives ultimately decided not to produce the segment as they felt that the story just wasn't right for the show. And yes, you can be sure I'll be ranting about that momentarily.
Ooh, I can't wait. Are the voices included? Do we get
no voices?
Oh, okay.
No voices this time because there's nobody to imitate. But
all right, I'll take the rant.
It'll happen soon.
DNA testing would eventually be performed on some of the items found in Denise's abandoned vehicle, including the cigarette butts and the paper cups. But as far as we can tell, they failed to draw a match with anyone. In April 2018, near the anniversary of Denise's disappearance, a new article was published about the case by an ABC affiliate in Pennsylvania. It featured a photograph of Denise's now 25-year-old son, William, who'd been raised by his grandparents in her absence and was engaged to be married. However, William has still not received answers about what happened to his mother and the exact circumstances of how Denise went missing remain a baffling mystery.
So I guess you could say the path went chilly. So like I mentioned in the intro, I am always perplexed by cold cases in which a victim travels a great distance and either goes missing or winds up dead at a location they had no reason to visit. I previously made a comparison to the Patrick Sean Kelly case, which we discussed weeks ago, but this is also reminiscent of another case I covered on The Trail Went Cold, which would make for a perfect Path Went Chilly episode, and that's the unexplained death of Jonathan Luna. In case you're not familiar with that case, Jonathan Luna was an attorney who left his office in Baltimore late at night and inexplicably took an all-night road trip, driving hundreds of miles through Delaware and New Jersey, before he wound up dead in a creek in rural Pennsylvania early the next morning with 36 stab wounds from his own penknife. It's always been up for debate whether Luna was murdered or committed a very elaborate suicide, but no one has ever been able to figure out why he spent the entire night driving through multiple states. Are you too familiar with that story?
This isn't the one that they covered on the new Unsolved Mysteries. Is it with the older man who might have been having a mental breakdown and they...
No, that was Jack Wheeler.
That is? Okay, yes. Then no, I have not heard of this case.
I've heard of it before. And one of the pieces of evidence that I'm not sure about was, did they find his own penknife by his body when they discovered it?
They did, yes. And they found blood in the back seat, and they also found blood on a toll ticket he had used that night, which seemed to indicate he had been bleeding before he even arrived at the location. It's one of the more baffling cases I've ever seen, and I think one of these days we should cover it on The Path Went Chilly, because there's a lot to talk about there, and it follows the same pattern of someone driving hundreds of miles for no apparent reason before they wind up dead under mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, I love those cases. I mean, love is the wrong word, but I find them incredibly fascinating. Like, we did Blair Adams, and that's got to be one of my favorite ones we've covered, even though it was one of our first we ever recorded together, because it's just so inexplicable.
And here we have Karen Denise Wells, who went missing during a cross-country road trip from Oklahoma to New Jersey, and oddly enough, her abandoned car was found in rural Pennsylvania, around 90 miles away from the location where Jonathan Luna was discovered. But while investigators were able to piece together most of Luna's movements during his road trip, there are still many pieces missing in Denise's case, and of course the key difference is that Denise's body has still never been found. It's pretty frustrating that Unsolved Mysteries had initially planned to do a segment about this story, as one of their researchers spent a lot of time scouting locations, talking to people connected to the case, and putting together a rough outline of the segment. But then the bigwigs decided that the story just, quote-unquote, wasn't right for the show, and for the life of me, I have no idea why they came to that conclusion. This case is so baffling and has so many weird twists and turns that it would have been absolutely perfect for Unsolved Mysteries. But hey, later that same year, the show produced a segment about a woman who dreamt about her dead grandfather coming to visit her and telling her how much she loved French toast, which is infinitely more compelling.
End of rant.
Yes.
Oh my God. No, I do wonder that sometimes. I mean, we've talked about this too with the reboot of Unsolved Mysteries in particular. There's so many fabulous cases with potential to be solved, and the way that that notoriety would provide, you know, eyeballs on this case again and a fresh light to a case. And then they do, you know, Otter stories and they're complete episodes of, you know, paranormal things or like you said, you know, grandpa's coming to talk about his French toast addiction, which is interesting, maybe as a 15-minute segment. But to think there's families who, if given the chance, there could be movement in a case, there's probably more compelling cases than the French toast ghost.
Well, I think Robin's going to give us some insight into why they probably shied away from more disappearances and more of these unsolved cases that seem to be really difficult to resolve.
Yes, as much as I love Unsolved Mysteries, their episodes really did become oversaturated with paranormal theme segments during the mid-90s, so it seems like a number of compelling true crime stories like this one got the shaft. The decision may have had something to do with the fact that the show did not have a great success rate at solving missing persons cases, as only 5 out of the 96 disappearances they profiled had been solved at this point. Regardless, it must have been a devastating blow for Denise's family, as getting her disappearance exposure on national television really could have given the case a major boost and helped fill in some of the major holes in this story.
Oh, 1,000%. Especially when you talk about these people were deep into production or, you know, like pre-production with the family. And that's got to be so exciting, so promising. As traumatic as it is to relive the case and to participate in media events, families really do kind of cling to that as the advocate for the case, as the people continuing to fight for answers, and then all of a sudden the rug's ripped out from underneath them. It's got to be devastating.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's one thing if the show just outright rejected them, but to get their hopes up like that and start production and make it sound like we are going to feature this and then to change their mind, and then you just see other ridiculous paranormal themed segments in its place as the years go along, I'm sure it must have been devastating for Denise's family. And I must say, I really would have loved to have seen an interview with Melissa Shepherd, because she obviously is kind of a shady character and probably would have dodged some questions. So it would have been interesting to see how she came across in an interview.
I wonder why that is. Do you think that it's because, not the Melissa thing, but the paranormal thing being featured more heavily? Do you both think it's because those cases don't necessarily get a resolution and nobody expects a resolution from them, that they're just there like strictly for our entertainment, whereas missing persons cases, an audience expects some kind of traction?
Maybe. I also think it does depend on the we talk about this always as well, the quote valuable victim versus not the valuable victim, and who people are attracted to in media segments. And here's Denise. She's a struggling single mom. She had had some issues. She's helping her exotic dancer friend. Like, I could see some of those factors also playing into that's not the ideal victim that media cases typically cover, but it does sound like they were going to cover it. So, Robin, do you have insight as to why they did not?
Yeah, I really wish I knew. They just said it was because it wasn't right for the show, even though, like I said, it seems like... Sorry?
I think it's that. I think it's the ideal victim thing, that you have so many cases, and if you watch who gets covered, you know, it's the wife who was at home and, you know, went missing with the back door open, that case we talked about, and, you know, the pastor's wife goes missing, and, you know, the little Caucasian girl goes missing. And a lot of times the pure victims, right, quote, end quote, do get more traction. And this case has a lot of things, drugs, exotic dancing, little things that if included in the segment, does it make it less attractive to the viewing public?
I find it interesting that some of the sources use the word executives rather than producers. So it may be a case where Unsolved Mysteries was all in on this, but maybe some executive at NBC did not think she was the ideal victim and said, no, don't do this case. Do something else. People are more interested in Grandpa's French toast or whatever.
Yeah. I've had several cases where, as a cold case expert, right, people call from media sources and they say, can you tell me about some of the most intriguing cold cases? And I'll talk to them about, you know, oh my gosh, there's this young black man who was playing basketball and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, well, tell me about his background, you know, and then they're like, nah, anything else? And I'm like, I know exactly what you're doing. This is not everybody. But that's something research shows is a very strong bias in the media. And it's got to be the quintessential, you know, perfect victim to really get a lot of attention. And so I could easily see someone saying, yeah, not this case. We're good.
I mean, her physical description, I'm looking at her VICAP alert missing persons poster, and her physical description and her pictures, like, she's a pretty blue-eyed blonde who's 5'6" and 120 pounds. So part of her description meets that criteria in that she's very photo friendly. You could see a photo like that on the cover of People magazine, because you see somebody like nowadays, Lauren DiMolo's disappearance. She's somebody who was involved with drugs, people who weren't on the up and up. There was a lot of shady characters in that story, but she's been on the cover of People. She's been on the cover of like all these different magazines, been featured on all the TV shows, despite those connections. And I'm so happy that she has, because her family is so lovely. I've spoken to her father, Paul, and sister, Cassie. But I think a lot of it does come down to the fact that she's a really pretty blonde woman. Mm-hmm. If she was a black woman, if she was a transgender individual, the case wouldn't have the same kind of traction. So on one hand, she isn't an ideal victim because, like, there's no evidence that she was involved in sex work or exotic dancing, was there, Robin?
No, all she had was really the arrest for check forgery, but there was no indication that she was involved in anything else.
So part of the research shows that it's also those social factors. So she had an arrest record. She had drugs in her car. Her friend was an exotic dancer. So you start seeing where, you know, like, class status plays into that ideal victim role as well, which is awful. It's tragic to think about, but that's how media makes their money. So I could see that being a huge factor.
Yeah, definitely at the time period, too. I could see it being a factor still, but I could see it being maybe less of a factor now. But in the time period that this took place, I think you could see them checking those boxes going, okay, well, will our audience care about this victim the same way that they're going to care about the French toast?
But I will give them credit. It was during this time period when they featured the Keith Warren case on Unsolved Mysteries. And if they hadn't have done that, then we probably wouldn't have heard of it.
That is true. Well, that is true. That's one of my favorite cases.
Like most of the other cases we featured on our podcast involving inexplicable road trips, we'll have to start at the very beginning. We know that Denise decided to leave her hometown of Haskell, Oklahoma, in order to make a cross-country trip to see her childhood friend, Melissa Shepherd, in New Bergen, New Jersey. While she was gone, Denise left her infant son with her parents, but it sounds like she didn't provide them with many specific details on why she was visiting Melissa, except that it was to help her with some, quote, personal problems. But right from the outset, there were a number of red flags about this trip. For starters, since Denise owned her own vehicle, why did she rent a Plymouth Acclaim? Keep in mind that Denise was unemployed at this point and raising a child as a single mother, so she probably didn't have that much money. She would be paying for enough gas to make a 1,300 cross-country road trip would be expensive enough, but forking out money on a rental car is even more costly.
Now, I will say, when Buddy and I used to go on long road trips, we would rent a car because we didn't want to put the mileage on our car. You know, like we wanted to make sure that our car had low mileage for resale and those kinds of things. So we were the nerds who would pull up at a rental car place and say, hey, we're just going to rent a car. But then again, you know, we weren't struggling with financial obligations like that. So I could see it being that, you know, maybe her car was older, maybe her car wasn't in good shape, or maybe she just didn't want to put the mileage on it.
That is possible. I haven't read many details about the type of car she owned at the time, if it was the type of vehicle you do not want to take on a cross-country road trip. But it could also be inferred that the reason she got a rental car is because she was instructed to do so, because she may, during this trip, may have gotten herself involved in stuff, maybe illegal, and they didn't want her using her own car for that. And while there's been a lot of talk about the inconsistencies in the timeline of Denise's travels through Pennsylvania, there's another odd inconsistency from Oklahoma, which I've never really seen addressed. When police published the official timeline in the Carlisle Sentinel newspaper 1 year after Denise went missing, it stated that she left her home in Haskell at 2 p.m. on April the 10th and rented a car in Tulsa at 9:30 p.m. Since it only takes around 40 minutes to drive from Haskell to Tulsa, why is there a gap of 7.5 hours?
What? That's a big one. So we have the 700 miles once she gets the car that are unaccounted for, but then we have 7.5 hours that are unaccounted for by the time she leaves and the time she rents a car in Tulsa. And that's a 40-minute drive from Haskell to Tulsa?
Yeah, and that's what's weird to me. And I'm surprised I've never seen people talk about that. I mean, I've only known about it because police published this timeline and those were the times they listed. And maybe they got something wrong. But theoretically, if you're talking about something like drug smuggling, maybe she was driving somewhere to pick something up in order to take it on a cross-country trip. But I just find that very odd. And the fact that she's also leaving at 9:30 p.m., it would be a lot more logical to begin your road trip earlier in the day at around 2, which is when she originally left her home.
And then just think how much she'd be on the road. She had a 22-hour drive ahead of her. So she's doing a 7-hour drive beforehand, or at least going somewhere. And so she's got to be absolutely exhausted. Like, she called and told Melissa, you know, I'm tired, I'm going to take a nap. Well, no joke. You've been on the go for, you know, 48 hours straight.
It's also odd, like Robin just mentioned, that Denise would decide to leave on her trip that late at night rather than wait until the following morning, which seems to indicate that she wanted to get to New Bergen as quickly as possible. All these peculiarities have led to speculation that Melissa may have convinced Denise to become involved in illegal activity, such as drug trafficking. Strangely enough, only a few days before Robin recorded his original Trail Went Cold episode on the case, he had watched the Clint Eastwood movie The Mule, in which Eastwood plays a character who finds himself in such a financial bind that he agrees to drive shipments of cocaine across the country for drug dealers. One of the reasons the drug dealers find him to be such an ideal candidate to be a drug mule is because he's an ordinary, law-abiding senior citizen who wouldn't arouse any suspicion. The April 16, 1994 edition of the Carlisle Sentinel specifically mentions that police found small amounts of marijuana and suspected cocaine in Denise's rental car. In that same article, Melissa Shepherd is quoted as saying, quote, she smoked a little pot every now and then, but cocaine, No way. Absolutely no way. Given the inconsistencies, which later popped up in Melissa's story, you could read a lot into her becoming so defensive over the idea that Denise might have used cocaine.
Oh, absolutely. And then when you think about, one, she could either be super defensive because maybe she did set her up to have cocaine in the car at some point and she's nervous of getting involved. But then again, if we know for a fact Denise would not use cocaine, I mean, I could see people being like, Ashley would never do something like that. Never. And trying to defend my moral character. But the reality is here, there might have been some cocaine. So what is the explanation? Denise did use recreational cocaine and, you know, Melissa didn't know it. Or like you guys are saying, does it make sense that she was actually picking up cocaine and delivering it perhaps to Melissa or to Melissa's associates that came that night?
Is it like Melissa doth protest too much? Like, no, she wouldn't touch cocaine. Cocaine, wouldn't even think of it. Maybe she would. I mean, you're not even living in the same place right now. So are you that aware of what your friend's partying habits are that you're going to say absolutely no way? Just saying, I don't think that she would do cocaine. That doesn't sound right.
Right.
Would be like less of a denial, you know, but like absolutely not is a bit emphatic. It seems a little too much.
Like she might be covering for the fact that sure, there would be cocaine in the car because I put it there or I made her put it there.
Exactly.
Now, I really hate to accuse a missing victim of being a drug mule, given that there isn't much hard evidence to support this, but you can see how someone might believe this is the case. I know that Denise was a very loving mother and had apparently turned around her wild ways from her teen years, but she did have a previous conviction for check forgery, so she wasn't immune to breaking the law. And of course, Denise was also unemployed at that time, and if she was desperate enough for money, I could see her getting roped into doing something she ordinarily wouldn't do, much like Clint Eastwood's character in The Mule. The expense of renting a car and paying for gas on a long cross-country road trip might have been worth it if there was going to be a substantial payoff at the end. But we'll talk more about the logistics and potential motives for Denise's trip on our next episode. That about brings an end to part one of our series about Karen Denise Wells, and join us next week for part two. So I want to thank you all for listening, and if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget that we are brand new, and any chance you have to share us on social media with a friend or to rate and review is greatly appreciated. You can email us at thepathwentchilly@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at thepathwent. So until next time, be sure to bundle up because cold trails and chilly paths call for warm clothing.
Music by Paul Rich from the podcast Cold Callers Comedy.
When someone is hurt in a truck accident, the one question everyone has is why did this terrible collision happen? To answer that question takes an experienced team of lawyers and experts. Not everyone has this type of experience. At Colombo Law, we are truck injury lawyers. It's what we do every day. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.